The Gospel of John, like the other three Gospels, tells the story of Jesus. Not the whole story. Just some of the main parts. Times an overview. In the original version, of course, there are no chapters and no verses. Those were added 1,000 years later for easy reference purposes. The original version was a story, a gospel story, a good news story, a biography, a very special kind of biography. In the Gospel of John, just like the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, everything in the Jesus story heads for that final confrontation between Jesus and the civil and religious authority. The confrontation between Jesus and the religious and civil authority leads to Jesus' arrest, his sentencing, his crucifixion and death, and finally, his burial. This is all told in the Gospel of John in chapters 18 and 19. Now, the normal sequence of events is that this would be the end of the Jesus story, because most biographies come to an end with the death of the subject. But as we know, it's not the end of the Jesus story, because the disciples experienced Jesus raised from the dead. Some of his followers met Jesus in a tangible, palpable, real-like way. So palpable, so tangible, so real that they say he is alive. The various stories of the disciples meeting the resurrected Jesus are told in all four Gospels. In the Gospel of John in chapter 20, we see that Mary Magdalene met the resurrected Jesus. We see that that core group of disciples on Easter evening meet Jesus, resurrected from the dead. Thomas, who had been away from that meeting, meets Jesus a week later in that same location. He meets the resurrected Jesus there. And then chapter 20 comes to an end with these words. And I can get them put up on the screen for you. It says this. This is the very end of chapter 20. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you may have life in his name. That's just another way of saying the end. The Jesus story is complete. If you didn't know it any better, you could put your Bible away at this point and think that you had read the whole Gospel of John. What more is there to say? If you accidentally flipped the page, you would notice, however, that there is a 21st chapter of the Gospel of John. And the chapter 21 begins with a rather odd story, if you think about it. It's the story of Peter and a core group of Jesus' disciples who are now back in Galilee. They're actually on the Sea of Galilee, Lake Tiberias, as it sometimes was called. They're actually pulling out the boat and they're going out on the water to fish. Don't you find this kind of a bit odd? This is where it all started, it seems. The story in John 21 is very much like the stories in the other three Gospels, but at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, when he calls the disciples in the first place. And now it's 3 years later. They've seen everything. They've heard everything. They've gone through the trauma of Jesus' death. They've been surprised, shocked by his amazing return. They've been through the ringer and back. So what are they doing in Galilee? What are they doing getting back into the fishing game after all they have been through? It's almost as if nothing has happened. We've done a complete 360 in the story. There's a complete circle. It's come all the way around again. We're back where we started with Peter and the other disciples. How can that be? I think the 12-step program is probably the most brilliant healing system that's ever been discovered or devised. And you do not have to be an addict in the traditional sense to appreciate it. The 12 steps have come to prominence through alcohol addiction, but it has many variations. There's Narcotics Anonymous. We have three, I think, right now, NA groups meeting in the church here. There's Food Addicts Anonymous, there's Gambling Anonymous, there's Pornhub, which is a 12-step program to help people deal with porn addiction. You don't have to have a formal addiction to use the principles, though. I think the principles apply in a variety of life circumstances. You see, the 12 steps program came out of the church. It came out of the Christian experience. The Christian understanding of our human condition being so fragile, how we live in often very fragmented ways in life, and who isn't challenged by their life circumstances, sometimes in profound ways. Here's the amazing thing that I want to draw your attention to the 12-step program and why its application has become so wide and varied. If you look over the 12 steps of AA, where it all started, there's no step where one commits to stop drinking. Think about that. There's no step where someone makes a commitment to stop drinking. I find that interesting. Do you? There are 12 steps, of course. There are a series of steps one takes, but there's no specific step where one outwardly commits to stop drinking. There's no emphasis in the 12 steps on the addictive substance itself, other than to acknowledge that this substance has put a person into a place of real vulnerability. Step one begins with this. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And after step one in the 12 steps of AA, alcohol is never mentioned again. Which means you can put anything into step one. Anything. You can put drugs into step one. You can put gambling. You can put pornography. You could put anger into step one. We admitted we were powerless over our anger, that our lives had become unmanageable. I know people like that. Do you? We could put in our timidity, our passivity. You know, freezing in the moment when you need to act. We admitted that we were powerless over those times when we freeze in life, when we need to act, so our lives have become unmanageable in that way. We could put our rigidity or our unwillingness to change into step one. We could put our desire to win in step one. That's one of my challenges. I put everything into a competition and I want to win. It can get in the way, you know, in your relationships. How you care for people. What does it mean to frame everything in a win-lose proposition? That can be quite destructive, you know. We can put greed last. We can put our desire to be right in step one, or our certainty in our opinions. We admitted we were powerless over our certainty of our opinions. You can put anything you can imagine into step one. But why is it that alcohol is never mentioned again after step one in the 12 steps of AA? And I think the reason is really, really simple. The addictive substance is not the issue. A compulsive or addictive habit isn't the ultimate issue at stake. Obviously, at some level, that addiction is a problem. The addictive substance is a problem. It has to be addressed. It can become a big problem, but it's not the problem. Ask anyone who's been active in NA or NA or GA or any of the 12-step programs for a number of years about this. Getting off the addictive substance is only the beginning. It's not the end. It's the beginning. It's the necessary. It's a necessary beginning. It's an important beginning, but it's not the end. It's the beginning. The real issue of addiction lies much deeper in people than the substance. You can still be an addict even without the substance. That's why people who have been sober for decades, when they introduce themselves at an AA meeting, will still use these words, "Hi, my name's Mark, I'm an alcoholic." That means the issue's not resolved yet, for me. See, the real problem and the real challenge of addiction lies within us. It lies within us. That's where the real issue is. According to AA, the problem's not found in a bottle or in a package. It's found in us. Something has got skewed in us. And if we overdwell on the substance, we might become misdirected to where the real problem lies. Which is why in the 12-step program, the addicting substance is only ever identified once. Right at the beginning, right at the front end, the addicting substance is significant, it can be important, but in the end, it's still a secondary detail. Now, most people won't ever use the 12 steps program because they don't identify themselves as addicts. I think that's a mistake, actually. I think everyone is an addict. Everyone has become addicted. How do I come to this conclusion? Well, it's not because I have deep insight to each of your circumstances and know where that addiction lies. I say this because I've noticed that everyone has one addiction in common. We are addicted to being ourselves. I'm addicted to being me, and you're addicted to being you. Doubt me about this? Try changing a simple habit in your life. Try changing a simple habit in your life, some habit you've had for a long time that you don't like. It's unbelievably difficult. Patterns become so deeply embedded in us, these patterns of behavior. People usually give up in trying to change because it is too hard. That's why most New Year's resolutions last a few weeks and then they're abandoned. It's too hard. Remember about a decade ago how we did complaint-free world as a community practice? How many were here at that point when we did the complaint-free world? The practice is this. It's pretty simple. You go 21 days without complaining, criticizing, or gossiping out loud. You can think what you like. The commitment to the practice is that you don't complain, criticize, or gossip out loud. We started with almost 100 people in the church doing it. It only lasted a couple of months. Most people gave up fairly early on. Nobody made it to the 21 days. When we tried it 5 years later, only 20 people signed up. Once burned, they say, what? Twice shy. We learned the first time around it was too hard. Try changing one of your mannerisms. Try changing what you focus your mind on in the moment. Try letting go of what upsets you and move to something else. It's very difficult. Sometimes it seems almost impossible. When I came to Trillium, some people complained to me that I spoke too fast. They had a hard time understanding me. And in listening to the audio recordings each week, I had to agree with them eventually. It took me a long time to agree with them. And even when I did agree with them, it took me a long time to change that way or pattern of speaking. In fact, I still find it hard at times. Many years later, it's still a challenge for me. And this is a simple mannerism. Try dealing with something complicated in you. It's hard. Now, I think, and I can imagine someone here saying to me, well, yes, I agree with you, Mark, about the challenge of change, but I don't like the word addiction, being addicted to yourself and to the patterns at play in your life inside of you, in your personality, in your temperament, in your mannerisms. Well, if you don't like the word addiction, well, then find a different word. That's okay. Personally, I like addiction. I think it really captures the power of what's at work in us. Those etched patterns of thinking, those etched, deeply embedded patterns of behavior in us that detract from our lives, probably much more than detracts, that sometimes it impairs our lives, even makes, at times, our lives unmanageable. I have a very high estimation of human potential. Do you? I mean, the scriptures say that we're made in the likeness of God. The scriptures say we're just a micrometer underneath the angels in potential. Our capacity to love, to grow, to build justly is immense, unlimited. But yet, something gets in the way. And it's found in you and me. Now, we all face obstacles in life. Everyone has their challenges, but I think for most of us, the biggest obstacle each of us faces in life is ourself. My biggest obstacle in life is me, and your biggest obstacle in life is you to finding true fulfillment, finding happiness, joy, peace. Yesterday, I was out on the Bruce Trail with Sally and a friend, and I was on my own at that point, and I was walking along this glorious ridge. You could see out into the greenness of life for miles and miles. It was a beautiful, sunny day, about 20 degrees Celsius. Just a glorious place. And yet, I'm complaining inside about something I'd read in the newspaper before I left. Is that not insanity? Truly, is that not insanity? And I kept bringing myself back to the moment, but then this thought would enter into me and would steer me away from being in the moment on this beautiful place. Is that not unmanageable in a way? We're so committed and determined to being what we are already, to knowing what we already know, to thinking what we already think, that I think it's become a compulsion in many of us. It has a life of its own. And it causes us not to recognize the multitude of opportunities and blessings that come to us in life. Opportunities for change and growth. Opportunities for joy and love. Jesus tells us that the only thing that matters in life, the only thing that matters in life is love, the giving and receiving of love. That's the only thing that ultimately matters. It's the only thing that will last in the end. It's the only thing that speaks to our full potential as children of God made in the likeness of the Creator. We were made for love according to Scripture, but try living the way of love for more than 30 seconds. And see what happens. We just can't stay with it, it seems. The compulsion to what is not love, what I call often unlove, is strong in us. And there's Peter and the other disciples after everything they've gone through with Jesus, the miracles and the teachings, the poverty and abundance of wandering through Galilee with him, the desolation of losing Jesus to death on a cross, the stupefying experience of meeting him again after it all, this, and yet nothing's changed. They're just the same as they always were, Peter and the disciples. It began with fishing, and it seems as if it's going to end with fishing. See, Peter and the other disciples are so committed to being themselves that even the most remarkable experience of human history can't change them. Something in them is determined to remain what they are. Established patterns are so rooted in them. Their reactive responses to life are etched deeply in who they are that they revert back to what they were in the end. Now tell me this isn't a kind of addiction. They're addicted to being themselves, and nothing, it seems, can move them from this place. Now I don't judge them. Honestly, I don't judge them because I know how hard it is to change, how deeply the patterns are etched in me. Now, I can't even put my finger on what the problem is. The Bible calls all this sin. All I know is that I'm out of step with something. Some inner rhythm is playing away under the surface of my life. I can't hear the sound. I can't hear it, but I can feel myself being out of sync with it. And I look around and I see a world out of step in a profound way. I look at the greed and violence at play in life. I look at the war in Ukraine as a perfect case study of our misguided ways in life with each other. And I think those disciples, they know it. Because at the end of the scene, when Jesus busts them for being there on the Sea of Galilee fishing, they don't even dare speak with him. They know. They know they've retreated back to what they were, which has nothing to do with what they're meant to be or where their future lies. And I've come to realize that what is missing for the disciples, and for me, maybe for you too, is a kind of surrender. We still haven't put up the white flag. After everything we've gone through in life, we're still determined to try to do it on our own. We simply haven't put up the white flag of surrender. You know, the Russians are losing the war in Ukraine, but they won't surrender. In fact, the disciples are going back to Galilee is in a way an act of defiance on their part, a hidden desire perhaps to resist God's will for them, an unwillingness to wait for direction. In the end, we're so committed to our claim, to our right to ourselves, no matter how many or what kinds of spiritual experiences we might have. Even meeting the resurrected Jesus Christ does not lead necessarily to that kind of surrender. And we'll talk more about this next week, about what it means to surrender our identity and ourselves back to God, what holds us back. See, the 12-step program is, at its core, a detailed plan of how to surrender. How am I going to surrender my identity, my claim to my right to myself, my compulsive, addictive ways of being me? How am I going to surrender that back to God? So I've come up with my own 12-step program for my addiction to being me. I offer this as just an example of how you might use the 12-step program. Because the 12-step program can be applied to any addiction, whether it's alcohol or drugs or gambling or anger. So why not my addiction to being me? Or perhaps even maybe your addiction to being used. And this is Mark's 12-step program of surrendering myself back to God. One, my addiction to being me has made my life unmanageable, especially in terms of love. That's what all matters in the end. What I live and how I live completely frustrates God's will for love in my life. I admit, step two, that I don't have the power to change myself. I'm 60 now. I think I've given myself enough time. What about you? Hockey's the man, and he's still young. I'll give him a few more years. But for me, I think at 60, I have a right to say, you know what? I can't do it. I've been given enough time. Three, step three, I realize I need to hand my life over to God. And I say, as a Christian, is revealed in Jesus Christ. It's time to hand my life over to God again. Four, step four, I will be fearlessly honest with myself about what needs to change in me. Step five will be fearlessly honest with you about what needs to be changed in me, what needs to change in me. Step six, I acknowledge that I'm ready to change. Step seven, I ask God to change me. Step eight, I acknowledge how the defects that arise from my addiction to being me hurts others. Step nine, where possible, I will make amends for the hurt I cause others and my addiction to being me. I hurt my wife Sally yesterday in my commitment to being me. That means the practice of forgiveness. We have a core value here. Seek and give forgiveness. Step 10, I'm committed to taking a daily scrutiny. Oh, step nine, sorry. Where possible, I will make amends for the hurt I cause others and my addiction to being me. Step 10, I am committed to taking a daily scrutiny of myself. Step 11, I seek to strengthen my connection with God each day through prayer and meditation. And step 12, I commit myself to sharing this understanding with others, which I'm doing right now. This is my practice of surrendering my life, my identity, and my will to God. And I invite you to think about how you might go about it in your own life, surrendering your life, your identity, and your will to God. You see, there's a whole world waiting for us on the other side of our surrendering to God. It's a world of joy and peace and love. Even in the topsy-turvy world of 2022, we can live with the true repose because we have surrendered our life to God. Those disciples at the Sea of Galilee, they ultimately surrendered to the Lord. And it changed not only themselves, but everything. We too can surrender ourselves to God and allow us to be changed so that through our change, we can change the world.